MacCast, Sunday, February 5th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it's been quite a week or so for Apple, especially considering the fact that they just came out with their latest quarterly earnings. And as I will be telling you in a little bit, they did quite well. You may be aware of this already, but we're going to get into all the details. Facts and numbers in this episode. We're also going to be talking about a interesting patent for Apple Watch and accessories for Apple Watch, some of the latest software updates that Apple released for iOS, also Apple continuing with its international manufacturing deals, and also moving some things around in the EU. We're going to get into that. Also talk a little bit about the LG 5K displays and a small issue that Apple ran into this last week. And also rumors of maybe some new processors for the Macs. We'll get into what all of that is about. And we also have feedback from you. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Apple TV app, as we've been doing the last couple episodes. I've been getting some great feedback from you. I got a question about Mail app and specifically drafts. And then we're going to get into a little Siri and Apple Maps, and also a hint and tip on the Touch Bar, and talk about the free space on your Mac and why in macOS Sierra that may be a little bit different than it was in the past. Should be a really great show. Glad to have you back here with me for another one. But before we get into everything, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Blue Apron. You know, it's Blue Apron's mission to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. What they found is that cooking together builds strong family bonds. As a matter of fact, research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often, and that's certainly been the case for our family. We find we're cooking more now that we've been using and enjoying Blue Apron. Having all of the ingredients delivered and in the right amounts makes it really convenient, especially when you get really busy. You know, it's not always easy to find the time to sit down and plan out meals, to do the shopping, and being able to save trips to the store and in that meal planning actually really means a lot to us. And if you're among busy people who spend a lot of time at restaurants or high-end grocery chains, you can actually get delicious home-cooked meals from Blue Apron for just under $10 per person per meal. And something that we've continuously been impressed by with Blue Apron is the quality and freshness of the ingredients. And there's a reason for that. A big part of it is having food delivered that doesn't go through the hands of a bunch of wholesalers, warehouses, and other middlemen. Blue Apron has actually established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranches across the United States, which means you get ingredients direct to your kitchen. So they're fresh and delicious every time. And I can say with certainty, every meal we've had so far with Blue Apron has been delicious. Plus, you get the recipe so you can make your favorites over and over again. So here's the deal. As a MacCast listener, you can try out Blue Apron for free. You can check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/MacCast. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/MacCast. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. So Apple totally rocked their first quarter 2017 earnings. In case you missed it, this past week, Apple shared their first fiscal quarter 2017 results, which covered the period from September 25th, 2016 through December 31st, 2016. So the holiday quarter, and it may be an understatement to say that the numbers were off the chart. They actually posted revenue of $78.4 billion and $17.89 billion in profit on sales of 13.1 million iPads, 78.3 million iPhones. That's one quarter, and 5.4 million Macs. As a matter of fact, their revenue was about 0.4 billion higher than the best guidance that they had given from last quarter. So they did very, very well. And the results were actually Apple's highest quarterly revenue ever in the history of the company. They also sold more iPhones than ever before, actually setting an all-time revenue record for not just the iPhone, but also services, the Mac, and Apple Watch, according to Tim Cook. And Macs was a good story there, too. Surprisingly, Macs were back up after declining the past few quarters, and I'm pretty sure that the new MacBook Pros actually helped that along quite a bit. Apple could have done even better had they introduced more Macs in 2016. So hopefully they'll see these results and look at 2017. They've already said they're going to be doing more with the Mac in 2017. So I would fully expect it. Mac moving back on track. And I know just hearing from a lot of you, you've written in and said, hey, I'm waiting to get a new Mac desktop. I'm waiting to get a new notebook. When is the right time? And I think, you know, between now and June, we should see some new Mac models at least announced, if not shipping. That's just my gut feeling, but I think it's going to happen, especially after seeing these numbers. Tim Cook also said that Apple Watch achieved records not only in terms of revenue, but also in terms of units during the holiday quarter. And Strategy Analytics came out with some estimated numbers. Apple doesn't give numbers, so it's just speculation, but they estimated that Apple sold 5.2 million, or shipped rather, 5.2 million Apple Watches in the fourth quarter of 2016. They estimated that overall for the quarter, smartwatch shipments were about 8.5 million. So if those numbers are correct, that would give Apple about 63% share of the smartwatch segment. So I think it's official. And actually, Rene Rishi wrote up a nice piece over at iMore. In case you missed it, you might want to check it out, mentioning that, you know, it's probably time to stop saying that Apple Watch is a failure. I think it's looking very much like Apple Watch has been a pretty big success for Apple. I look around when I'm walking around, I'm starting to notice more when people do have a watch on their wrist, you know, what are they wearing? And I can say just, you know, it's not strong evidence that Apple is dominating. But when I look, if it's a smartwatch, chances are it's an Apple Watch, at least in my experience, either that or it's some sort of fitness band. And so I've seen Fitbits, I've seen some of the Fitbit watches, but overwhelmingly, I think I'm seeing more and more Apple Watches. And I think a lot of it has to do with the services surrounding Apple Watch, specifically Apple Pay. And we'll talk about Apple Pay here in a second as well, because it's doing extremely well. Let's talk about iPads, though. Again, the one potential down spot is iPad sales continue to decline. Shipments were down 19% year over year, and revenue was down 22%, coming in at just over $7 billion. I think a big part of that was the fact that there were no new iPads this fall. So obviously, that had an impact on these numbers. You know, no new iPads, nothing for people to buy. They're kind of sticking with what they have. I think a lot of people are sticking with what they have. Anyway, Apple did try to put a bright spin on it, though. They said that 13.1 million units sold was actually higher than their expectations. And they noted that the iPad has an 85% market share of tablets above $200 in the U.S. So they're trying to remain positive on iPad. But I think really if they want to see any kind of impact happen with iPads, they need to put out new models. So hopefully that'll happen here in the spring. And also, you know, Apple is due to refresh the lineup. So look for iPad to do a little bit better in Q2 and Q3 of this year of 2017. But, you know, overall, I think people are just upgrading tablets less frequently. In some ways, I kind of feel like Apple is a little bit of a victim of their own success when it comes to the tablet, because I know in my family, we have original iPad minis, and we're not looking to replace them anytime soon. They run great. They work fine. About the only downside is that they don't have enough storage. They're 16 gigabyte models, and we wish they had a little bit more storage, but we're kind of managing that. But as far as running apps on a day-to-day basis, yeah, they're a little bit slow. They're feeling a little bit slow, but it doesn't feel like it felt back in the days when you would have an a slow notebook where it really felt like there was this need to upgrade. So, you know, I know people, it's a little bit sensitive because some people feel like Apple's doing things with the OS and with the operating system and with apps to try and force upgrades a little bit more with iPad. But I think overall, it's just kind of the way it's going to go. I think iPads, tablets are on a 3, 4, maybe 5 year cycle for people to upgrade. And Apple's just going to have to fall into that pattern. And it's one reason why I think moving forward, we'll see iPad tablet updates a little less frequently, probably more in line with how we see Mac updates. I expect Mac updates to slow down a bit too. And we've talked about this before. We're already starting to see it, and that's going to lengthen. iPhones, those are the big part of Apple's business at this point, and those are going to continue to get cranked out. So this is just kind of the way things are going. But iPad is kind of that down number for Apple. But everything else, very, very high up there. And as far as revenue generating, there was extremely high demand for the iPhone 7 Plus last quarter, and that actually drove the average selling price for iPhone up for Apple from $619 in September in the September quarter to $695 this quarter, which is a big part of that almost $18 billion in profit that Apple drove for the quarter. Services were also, once again, a very big highlight, almost $7.2 billion in revenue generated for Apple. And between iCloud and Apple Music, Apple says they now have over 150 million customers paying for a reoccurring subscription to one of their services. And Apple expects their services business to actually be the size of a Fortune 100 company sometime this year. And they're planning huge growth for services. They're expecting to double the size of their services business over the next 4 years. And I absolutely believe it. And a big part of that, too, as I was mentioning earlier, was Apple Pay. Apple Pay was big. Apple says Apple Pay users tripled from over a year ago, and the transaction volume was up 500% year over year. I know for a fact that I'm using Apple Pay much more frequently, and because of the convenience of it, I find that if I can use it, I actually really want to use it. I've seen it now on vending machines. It's finally getting to the gas pump. And for me, these are the kinds of things that make a difference. And I do hope and continue to hope that Apple works very hard on the retail side to get retailers to push and adopt Apple Pay. Because I think so far they've done a great job with the banks and the credit card companies. But really, if they want to see this kind of growth continue, it's really about consumer awareness and getting consumers and, more importantly, retailers to accept Apple Pay at the register. And we're starting to see a little bit of that, and it's becoming more visible. And I think if you look at these numbers, you can see the impact that it's making. So what to see in the future, you know, you really have to see, look at what Apple's business makeup is. I think it makes a really big difference. And if you look at revenue by category, 69% of Apple's revenue is iPhone. So iPhone is going to be a really big driving force in Apple moving forward. You know, it seems like it's been waning a little bit, and they are going to have to transition to something else. But for right now, it's still the big thing that Apple does. And then that's followed up by services and the Mac, which are now equal in terms of revenue generation. 9% of Apple's revenue came from services, 9% came from the Mac. And keep in mind, this was in a quarter where Mac was up, whereas in the past, it's been a little bit less. So services is kind of Apple's second level of business. And I think that's why we see them doing a lot more with Apple Music, with iCloud services. And I fully expect that to continue and expand. Why we're hearing about Apple looking at original TV content or trying to do some sort of television service, I expect we'll be hearing more about that in the coming year because they're going to want to drive up that part of their business. Macs, still important, 9% of the business. I think Apple's going to have a continued focus on the Mac, and they've already said many times they're still dedicated to the Mac. It's just not the biggest part of their business. They're not letting it go. It's still going to be around for those of us who are diehard fans and don't want to see our Macs going away anytime soon. And then it's iPad after that. iPad representing about 7%. And then everything else, the other, which is your things like Apple Watch, accessories, headphones, 5%. So all important parts of the business, but you can see the huge discrepancy between iPhone and all the other parts of Apple's business. And that's just going to be the way the makeup is. But pay attention, a little bit more attention to those trucks in 2017, because I think we're going to be hearing about those a bit more. So that was kind of the makeup for Apple in the first quarter. Great first quarter. We'll have to see how things shape up for Q2. But first quarter is almost always Apple's biggest quarter of the year. So, you know, expect things to still be good, but maybe not that good. And Apple's guidance kind of reflects that. But fun numbers from Apple this time around, and a little bit of it surprising, I think. Apple Insider uncovered a very interesting patent that could give us some hints about the future, or Apple's future plans for Apple Watch. They found this patent that Apple was awarded last week that showed a link bracelet style band. But the thing about it was, it wasn't just a piece of jewelry. The individual links were actually little tiny electrical components that could be connected together as you put the link bracelet together. So each link had potentially a different capability that could be added to the Apple Watch. So it described links that were batteries, some links were photovoltaic cells, electricity generators, cameras, haptic output devices, speakers, just about everything that you could possibly think of to fit into a tiny little link bracelet. And to be fair, this isn't really a new idea. Many people have discussed this idea of having extra functionality in the band. There were also some smartwatches that came out on the market already that had little cameras and sensors, additional batteries inside the band. But I think the unique thing about this patent was sort of this modular design, this idea that you could potentially mix and match components together just by clipping them to form this sort of, you know, component band was very, very interesting. And, you know, it's been said that Apple's wanting to add more and more sensors, especially health sensors, into the Apple Watch. And the band seems like a logical place for that. Also, more battery life, this idea of having electric generators. You know, you have self-winding watches and you can use movement to generate power. It's not going to be a lot of power, but all of these things could actually potentially extend the battery life that's built into the watch. You know, you have solar cells, photovoltaic cells built into the band. So when you're out and about, you're getting a little extra juice. Again, it's not going to be a lot, but it could be enough to add throughout the day, say another hour of battery life, which could be significant. So interesting to see this patent. Gives us a little insight into what Apple's thinking about for the potential future of Apple Watch. And it was cool to see that over at Apple Insider this week. Apple put out some new betas this week for developers, specifically iOS 10.3, which actually has some pretty big surprises. You know, the last couple of point releases for iOS have really been about bug fixes more so than kind of feature enhancements, but there were some significant feature enhancements being noted in the 10.3 release, specifically Apple File System. Apple's been working on a new file system. It's expected to be coming to iOS and the Mac at some point. It looks like iOS is probably going to get it first, and maybe with this next release. The big deal about Apple File System is it's a whole new file system to replace their aging HFS Plus file system. Actually, we could even argue at this point that HFS Plus is ancient. And the big deal about the new file system is that it's really optimized for flash and SSD storage. It includes features like strong encryption, space sharing, copy on write metadata, cloning for files and directories, snapshots, and a whole bunch of other really cool stuff. But the way this was noted sort of in the 10.3 beta release was that Apple was really recommending making a full backup before downloading and installing this new update, right? It's a brand new file system. It's basically replacing what's under the hood there. So it's going to be even more critical when this gets released that you really update. So far, we haven't heard about anybody having any real big issues, but it's still early days. This is the first beta of 10.3. And so expect to be hearing more about Apple File System as we get closer to release. Another big feature that was discovered in 10.3 is a new Find My AirPods feature that allows you to play an audible sound from an AirPod if you're missing it. And it works through the Find My iPhone app. So you can go in there. As you're playing the sound, you can choose to mute the left or right AirPod. And as a matter of fact, Apple advises that when you activate the feature, you make sure you don't do it while you have an AirPod in your ear, because I've been told it's actually pretty loud and pretty audible. But it does mean that you're going to have to kind of be in the range or in the area where the AirPod is. And as a matter of fact, to get the feature to work at all, you do need to have the device that it was last paired with, and you do need to be within the Bluetooth range of the AirPod that you lost. So it's going to show you the last known position. So the last time it knows that it was connected, you can kind of get into that area. So maybe near your car, or if you were in your house, or maybe at the park. So once you get in range and it reconnects via Bluetooth, you can activate the Find My AirPod feature. So not quite as cool as the AirPod Finder app that I told you about and that Apple pulled. And we kind of know now why Apple maybe pulled that application, because they were coming out with their own similar style feature. They probably wanted to avoid any kind of confusion, but it's really not quite the same, because the one cool thing about the Finder for AirPods was that it would actually, I think, use kind of the Bluetooth signal to get you in range. So I think it'd be really good if Apple adopted that kind of functionality to where you could actually get close, because to hear the audible sound, you're going to need to be near wherever the AirPod actually is. So if it could get you within the Bluetooth range or even closer, then you could activate the audio feature and actually probably hear it. And overall, there is kind of a question about how useful is this feature going to really be, and how many people are actually really going to need this feature. John Gruber actually pointed out in a piece, and I'll link to it in the show notes at macast.com, that the likelihood of losing an AirPod is probably smaller than a lot of people want us to believe. One of the reasons he points out, and I think this is actually true, because AirPods are expensive, people, myself included, tend to be a little bit more careful about what we're doing with them. I try to pay really close attention when I'm taking them out of my ear, making sure they end up back in the case, making sure I put the case in a safe place. And just a little side tip here, I can't remember if I mentioned this before, I found that the fifth pocket in my Levi's jeans is the perfect size. You know that little extra pocket in your jeans? It's the perfect size for the AirPod case. It fits right inside there, nice and snug. It's not going to pop out or come out. So I always try to make sure they're in there. Another thing about AirPods is, so far for me, I found that they do not fall out easily, despite what most people think. Unless you're putting on a hoodie or something's going over your head, maybe you're taking a sweatshirt on or off that might catch the AirPods, they could fall out then. But most of the time, you would probably notice that immediately. I've never had an instance where I was out walking around or jogging or anything like that where they've fallen out. They do tend to come a little loose from time to time, but you just kind of push them back in and they stay in. Again, it's probably going to depend on the shape of your ears and how well they fit for you. But once again, if they don't fit for you, you're probably not going to buy them. You're probably not going to notice, or you're probably going to be aware that, hey, these aren't going to work for me, rather. And again, when you take them out, you tend to put them in the case. So my biggest issue with them so far is I'll actually forget where I put the case, and the Find My AirPods feature is not going to work in that scenario. It's only for actually finding the individual earbud. It will not help you find the AirPods if they're both tucked away in the case somewhere. So that's kind of a big update in 10.3. Another thing that a bunch of people noted was that Apple is going to limit review pop-ups in apps. I'm kind of actually excited about this. So how many apps do you have where they'll pop up periodically and ask you, hey, give us a review in the App Store? That can get really annoying. There's actually a new reviews API being built into iOS that will limit the number of pop-ups a developer can put up to 3 times a year, and will give you the ability to turn off those pop-ups entirely. It will also allow you to submit reviews for the app without actually having to leave the app, so it can pop up and you can actually make your review right inside the app. Now, eventually, the API is going to be the only way that Apple will allow pop-up reviews. In this first iteration, it's sort of going to be opt-in, but eventually, I think they're going to force people onto this platform. Apple also told Jim Dalrymple and John Gruber that when iOS 10.3 ships to developers, they're going to get the ability to respond to customer reviews in both the App Store and the Mac App Store, something developers have wanted for a very long time. So if somebody leaves a negative review or a critical review, they can actually respond to that and say, this is what's going on, and you can see that publicly. They're only able to leave one public response for each user review that gets posted. And those will be attached to the review in the app stores in sort of a thread-like fashion. So I think that's going to be really helpful in sort of letting developers have a voice when they get a negative review. And I think that's important, the ability to respond. Hopefully, most developers will be respectful and respond in a respectful fashion. I'm sure we'll hear of some cases where there's a little bit of flame war and abuse going on, but hopefully that will be somewhat limited. Knowing Apple, they'll try and keep a control on that. But I think this is good, both the review pop-up thing and the ability for developers to respond. The other thing we have to get prepared for that was noted in 10.3 is 32-bit apps going away. You may have to date seen some of these, what we call developer shame warnings for 32-bit apps. So if you have an old app that hasn't been updated in a while, you launch it on a current iOS device running a current version of iOS, you will get this little pop-up that says this app may slow down your device. That's a 32-bit app running. Now Apple is stating in a new version of that pop-up that in the next release, these apps will no longer function. So they're warning that after 10.3, 32-bit apps are no longer going to run. As a matter of fact, back in February of 2015, Apple actually required that any new apps submitted to the App Store had to be 64-bit compatible. And in June of 2015, any app updates were required to be 64-bit compatible. So you might be wondering, well, what about all these abandoned apps? Well, Apple's been actually cracking down on those for the last couple months. And so you probably, if you have one of these older apps that you really rely on, you probably want to reach out to the app developer if you can, if they're still around, and ask them to update their app to put out a 64-bit compatible version. Or if you can't do that, you might want to start looking for alternatives. I found that a lot of these apps, for me at least, are older games that I still enjoy playing and they still run. So it's going to be kind of sad to lose these apps, but it may eventually happen. I haven't really found a critical app, for me at least, that I rely on that hasn't been updated to run in 64-bit. So I'd be curious to know from you, do you have any really critical, like, day-to-day utility or productivity apps that you rely on that are throwing up this message? Or is this really not going to impact that many users? You know, iOS devices with 64-bit chips, those include the iPhone 5S and newer, the iPad Airs and newer. So none of the older iPads, like fourth generation or earlier, have 64-bit support. And for the iPad Mini, it's iPad Mini 2 and newer, and the sixth generation iPod Touch. So this may be one of those methods that Apple's using to kind of force iPad upgrades, maybe iPhone upgrades. I don't really know the strategy or the idea behind this, because developers really just need to build their apps with 64-bit support. A 64-bit app can also have a 32-bit support built into it. So you can kind of target both of them with Xcode. As far as I know, if you're an iOS developer and I'm getting this wrong, let me know. But I think you can actually, you don't have to just build for 64-bit. So if you're rocking an older 32-bit device, to me, this is a message saying the obsolescence clock is kind of ticking and getting closer to 0 hours. So it might be time to think about upgrading. A couple more versions of iOS, and then I think it's going to be Apple saying, nope, we're 64-bit only. And this little pop-up message seems to be the first indication of them moving in that direction and in a really firm way. And then finally, one little thing that was noted as a potential new feature, not something that's built into iOS 10.3, but something interesting. A developer, Steve Trotton Smith, actually found this little floating one-handed iPhone-sized keyboard for iPads that are 7.9 inches or smaller. So this doesn't seem to be available for the iPad Pro, but 9.7-inch and smaller iPads, it's this little floating one-handed keyboard that might be handy. But again, it's sort of a hidden feature. You can enable it under 10.3, but it's not on by default. So it may be something Apple is considering for a future version of iOS. Apple also put out a new version of watchOS for developers, watchOS 3.2. The big thing there is it had the theater mode we'd been hearing rumored about potentially for iOS, but it's showing up in watchOS first. It's kind of got the little theater mask icon. It appears in the control center, and when you tap it or activate it, what it does is it completely mutes all of the sounds on your Apple Watch and disables the raise to wake feature. There actually was a reference to it being in iOS 3.1.1 or 3.1.3, the update that came out I think last week or a couple weeks ago, but it didn't show up in there. It does look like it's going to be in watchOS 3.2. Taptic alerts when the feature is on still happen, so you'll be able to feel that. But in order to see them, you'll need to use the digital crown, the new peak feature, or actually tap on the screen to get the screen to wake up. So the idea here is you're in a movie theater. When you're lifting your hand to drink your soda or something like that, your watch screen isn't going to come on and distract people. And obviously, you're not going to get the audible alerts. Personally, I always keep my audible alerts off, so that doesn't change much for me. But there are some thoughts that this theater mode may also make its way into the iPhone at some point. So you kind of have a single button where you can disable all audio and make sure that the lift to wake feature on your screen doesn't activate to distract a bunch of people. And then the other big news in watchOS 3.2 is they're bringing in support for SiriKit. This is mainly for developers. It will enable them to use SiriKit features on the watch. So that means being able to access messaging, payments, ride booking, workouts, calling, and photo apps, searching photos from photo apps via Siri on the watch. This is something that came to the iPhone and the iPad and iOS, but hasn't been available on the watch yet. So expect to be able to do more Siri functionality on Apple Watch once watchOS 3.2 hits. A couple other little things to note. HBO Go is finally available and supported on the TV app. So if you're an HBO Go subscriber, to date, only support for HBO Now had been in place. Now, subscribers to HBO through their cable provider who use the HBO Go app will find that stuff in the new TV app. And they also added single sign-on for HBO Go. And then AirPods actually also got their first firmware update. They were updated to version 3.5.1. And in case you're going, well, I didn't get a notification about that, it actually happened quietly. It happens automatically in the background. So if you have AirPods, when they're in their case and when they're charging and paired to your device, the firmware update should happen automatically. And in case you want to check it, you can check it by going into the settings, general about screen on the iOS device that's paired and connected to your AirPods. And when you do that, there should be an extra AirPod item in the about screen. If you don't see it, again, double check and make sure that you're paired and connected currently with the AirPods to that device. And then when you see the AirPods in that section, you can tap on it and check the firmware version. And if it says 3.5.1, you've already got the update. If you don't have that, just plug in the AirPods, you know, put them in the charging case, plug in the charging case, and it should automatically update. And so that's some of the latest updates from Apple. Apple continues to make manufacturing deals all over the world. This time around, Apple has been working harder to try and get a manufacturing deal done in China, in India, rather. They've been doing deals in China. This week, they have been working to get manufacturing in China. They met with the government last week, and they said they had a, quote, constructive and open dialogue. Apple is looking for a number of concessions from India, including a 15-year tax holiday on imported components and equipment, and possibly some waivers on import duties. They are remaining flexible, however, because India typically doesn't give those kinds of concessions to companies. And because Apple would really like to open some retail locations in India, but in order to do that, they do have this requirement to do manufacturing locally. So they're trying to get a deal done. They're working. A government source told the Wall Street Journal that the arrangement is almost a done deal and that the finance ministry is looking into Apple's demands, calling many of them, quote unquote, workable. So seeming like the Indian government is willing to work with Apple on some of this. They've been having some back and forth. But we can expect that they'll get some sort of manufacturing deal done. Now, I don't know if this is directly related, but the Times of India also confirmed this week that Apple's Taiwanese manufacturing partner, Wistron, will be assembling iPhones in India. They did not give an exact timeline, but it is believed that that production will start in June. So I think the other report is more Apple trying to directly get some manufacturing done in India. Whether it can be through a third-party partner or not, who knows, but we had been hearing that Wistron was looking to do iPhone assembly in India, and it does sound like that is going to be happening. So we'll wait and find out if this does meet Apple's requirements and see if they start opening up some retail locations in India soon. It could happen, but there may be more deals to be done, so stay tuned. The Wall Street Journal is also claiming that Apple has been looking into flexible LCD technology from Japan Display. They say that Apple is considering potentially using the new panels for future iPhones that would allow for quote unquote bendable phone designs. Japan Display actually plans to start mass producing screens as early as 2018, but I really wouldn't get too excited. The displays are plastic, and as you know, Apple prefers to use glass in their displays. Still, this idea of displays that are bendable or foldable is an interesting concept from a design point of view. So if we're looking at what our future iPhone design is going to look like, these kinds of materials, I think it makes sense, you know, would be things that Apple would want to explore. Now, when we say bendable, don't get the idea that they fold in half or anything right now. It just means that they're flexible. They can kind of shape and conform and fold around and bend rather around edges and stuff like that. Apple would still need other kinds of support structures and internal components built into their design that could adapt to that kind of form factor as well. So it's not just a matter of getting, you know, a display that can curve. You got to figure out how do we make the internal components, the frame structure, and things like that adapt to that. So it's fun to think about the possibilities of a bendable or flexible, foldable LCD display. And obviously, Apple is thinking about it, but what that will turn out to be in terms of an actual finished product, who really knows? In the shorter term, though, Japan Display could actually end up being another supplier for Apple. We have had the rumors that the design of the iPhone 8 will have kind of curved edges, and flexible LCD technology could be part of that. Although, again, it's been rumored that the iPhone 8 will be using OLED technology, and currently the Japan Display technology is just LCD. So who knows if Apple will actually add them on as another supplier, but they're at least exploring the technology, according to the Wall Street Journal. Apple is moving all of their non-US side iTunes business out of Luxembourg and over to Ireland. That means the iTunes Store, Apple Music, the App Store, and the iBook Store, starting as early as this week, will be run out of their headquarters in Cork, Ireland. Apple actually announced this move back in September when it transferred an estimated 9 billion, about 7.2 billion pounds of iTunes assets, and they moved their developer contracts to Apple Distribution International, which is one of their main Irish companies. So it's been planned for a while. They're actually making the move this week, and the move could, I think, ruffle the feathers of some of the authorities in the EU who have accused Apple in Ireland of setting up a low tax rate haven and accused them of anti-competitive practices when it comes to the other member states in the EU. Apple has supposedly received as low as an effective tax rate of 0.005% in Ireland, and some in the EU have alleged that that actually constitutes illegal state aid. And as a matter of fact, the EU had ordered Ireland to collect an additional 13 billion euro, about 10.8 billion pounds, in taxes from Apple. But this past week, the deadline for that actually came and went, and Apple didn't make the payment. So we're going to have to find out how that ends up going forward. But to date, Apple has insisted that their tax practices completely comply with the laws, and both Apple and Ireland are appealing the EU ruling, as you probably know. So it'll be interesting to see how this pans out. But certainly, Apple moving more business into Ireland probably isn't actually helping smooth the waters with the authorities in the EU, although I don't particularly think they nor Ireland are too worried about it. And I'm sure Ireland is happy to have the extra jobs and the extra business from Apple. The LG 5K display. Many people have been waiting for this display to ship. It looks impressive, but it might have a slight issue. This was actually reported first by 9to5 Mac. They noted an issue with the new LG 5K display when connected to a MacBook Pro and placed near a Wi-Fi router. What they were finding was that the display would actually start to lose the connection and could cause the MacBook Pro to freeze up entirely. The issue was first suspected by some of the reviewers on the App Store. As a matter of fact, one noticed that as his network traffic increased, his screen would start to flicker and eventually go black based on the proximity to his router. And 9to5 Mac did some additional testing, and they confirmed the issues with one of their displays and noted that when it was placed less than 6.6 feet away from the router, they would start to have connectivity and crashing issues. Now, not all of the LG 5K display units appear to be affected by this, but Apple Insider did confirm that both LG and Apple engineers were examining the situation. And then later in the week, LG came out with a statement saying that it had identified a hardware problem with the new displays, and they said that Wi-Fi routers within 2 feet of the display actually resulted in signal interference issues. Because of the problem, they said that they would be adding additional enhanced shielding to all future models, starting with shipments in February, and they said that existing customers with affected displays should contact their nearest LG customer service center for service. So it sounds like they're going to be taking care of the issue. I guess if you are the owner of a LG 5K display and have run into this, you kind of have the option. I would imagine you could either move your display further away from your Wi-Fi router or contact LG and see how they're going to take care of you. My assumption is they're going to be swapping out affected units and giving you the new enhanced shielded units moving forward. But if you're buying an LG 5K display after February, they're saying you shouldn't have this problem. So we'll have to wait and see if whatever they discovered ultimately fixes the issue. I do know I had a report from at least one MacCast listener who was having crashing problems with his new LG 5K display, specifically with his machine waking from sleep. I don't know if this was the actual issue. I emailed back and I haven't heard back yet, but I'll let you know. I'll give you an updated report to find out. If you have been hit by this issue, let us know about it. Let us know your experience. And more specifically, if you've dealt with LG customer service, how is that going? What are they doing to resolve your issue? Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally, in the news for this week, there are rumors that Apple may be looking to bring ARM processors to future Macs. Yeah, I know this rumor seems to come up at least once a year, maybe more frequently, but this time around, it's Bloomberg's Mark Gurman and Ian King. They wrote a piece claiming that Apple has been developing a new ARM-based chip, for use in future Mac laptops, possibly as soon as later this year. The difference this time around is that the chip in future models would be a more capable version of the one we're already seeing in Apple's new MacBook Pro that is handling the touch bar support. So Apple kind of has this hybrid operating system that drives the touch bar and works with Mac OS. It's a variant of the iOS operating system, and that touch bar has its own CPU. It has a ARM-based CPU that drives it. So what they're talking about here with this future version is a more kind of a more capable version of that. They're saying internally Apple has codenamed it the T310, and it would be designed to handle more of the low power mode functionality in the notebook, kind of taking over for the main Intel-based CPU. So it would still have an Intel processor, but then this sort of supplemental processor. They claim the new chip would take over the current PowerNap tasks, which is what allows your Mac to actually, in the background when it's asleep, do things like retrieve emails, install software updates, synchronize your calendar and contact data, all that stuff that happens in, you know, using very little power with the Intel CPU could even use less power when, you know, having a dedicated ARM-based CPU. So the idea here is sort of hybrid, this hybrid or dual CPU design. And I think it's very interesting. To me, it seems a lot like the dual GPU designs we have now, where if you're doing a graphically intensive task and you have a MacBook Pro that has a discrete GPU as well as the integrated Intel GPU, that discrete GPU takes over for high-powered stuff. But when you're just doing average run-of-the-mill tasks, you get to use the lower-powered integrated GPU, and that saves on battery life. That extends your battery life. So the idea to be able to do this with the CPU, to me, seems really interesting. And as I said, the report only mentions the PowerNap scenario, but I can imagine Apple taking the concept even further and future design. So imagine the ability to seamlessly move computing tasks, CPU tasks, to the most efficient processor to extend battery life. Intel processors, I think, already kind of do this with managing cores, and they can, I think, adjust the power levels depending upon tasks. But the ARM chip would have an even greater ability to kind of take this to a whole new level. So you'd have no need to use a power-hungry CPU if you were just, say, working on a text document or surfing the web or answering emails or stuff like that. Why not move that onto a low power, very energy efficient ARM processor? And then when you fire up Photoshop, boom, you just jump over, you switch over to your Intel CPU and, you know, 8 cores and go to town. But then when you're back on your average tasks or you have things in the background, you just move that stuff around. So it's a really interesting idea in computing, and it'll be interesting to see where Apple takes this. But this could be how we get ARM-based Macs. Now, the report notes that there's no immediate plans to move away from Intel as the main processor over to ARM, but this, to me, could be kind of the first moves toward a switch. There's nothing to prevent Apple from developing a really high-powered multi-core version of an ARM processor, but for immediate needs, this idea of, you know, having this lower power processor and a higher power, more powerful multi-core processor makes a lot of sense. But in the future, I could imagine that Apple could start with lower end, lower cost models of the Mac, maybe moving to an ARM-based processor that's much more energy efficient and works for various designs. And I think that could eventually happen, maybe even, you know, in the next year or two. So interesting times with processor designs and technologies and stuff like that. And it was kind of cool to see this report this week. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now, moving on, I want to talk a little bit more about the TV app. We've been talking about this back and forth, you know, the advantages, disadvantages. Because of the conversations we've been having, David actually wrote in to tell me about a scenario he was having, and it was frustrating him a little bit because with the respect to the TV app, he lives in a more remote area and relies on a cellular data connection for his internet access. And because of the limited bandwidth and the cost, he doesn't always have the ability to have kind of this always-on connection. And I know that there's people that live out in more rural areas, maybe where you have satellite internet, that are in the same boat. You know, you kind of have to manage your time, you have to manage your bandwidth. And with no internet connection, David says the TV app, quote, will not fully load if it cannot call back at the Apple mothership when it starts up. So when he starts up his TV app, he says, I only have a blank, unusable screen with no way to access the video media that's already on my iOS devices. So he's talking about ripped movies, saved programs, stuff that he has loaded locally. When he fires up the TV app, he's not getting access to that. And that would also mean potentially that, you know, when you're traveling, if you're in airplane mode, you're going to have a problem. You know, Apple used the TV app and it replaced the video app. And I had never thought about this, so I was kind of curious after receiving David's email. So I put my iPhone into airplane mode and tried to see what would happen. And David, my experience was a little bit different, so I don't know if you're just specifically having an issue with your TV app or what's going on. But sure enough, I can confirm that when it fired up and I tried to go to the Watch Now tab, which was the default for me, it was completely blank. Other than it had a big message that warned you're offline. The store tab also warned me that I was offline, as well as the search tab. So you had kind of three tabs that were completely non-functional without a internet connection. But for me, when I switched over to the library tab, it went in directly into the downloaded section, which shows all of the content that was downloaded to my device. Now, when I originally did it, I didn't have any content, so I can confirm it came up completely blank. There was nothing in there. But when I went ahead, reconnected, downloaded a movie locally, and then put it into airplane mode and fired up the TV app, it threw me into, when I was in the library section, into the downloaded section and showed me the one movie that I had downloaded. I could also tap show all, and then it would show me everything that was downloaded, movies, TV shows, whatever it might be. So as far as I can remember, this to me seems to work at least similar in some ways to the way the video app would behave when you didn't have a connection. If you had a connection, you could actually go into the video app, and if you had the option set, you would have the ability to see both locally already downloaded content and other purchased content that was on the iTunes store, where you'd get the little cloud icon and you could have the option to download it. But if you went on a plane or you put it in airplane mode or you were in an area where you did not have a connection, I believe it would just show you the locally stored video content. And even, you know, so that is a little bit different, and maybe that's why you were kind of seeing a blank screen. Maybe you didn't have anything loaded locally. I don't really know. But you should still be able to use the TV app in the same way that you used the old video app. One other thing about the TV app, though, that I did notice was that if you do only have access to a cellular connection, there are some new settings that can help control the amount of bandwidth that you might end up using when you're on cellular. So if you go into settings on your iOS device and then go into the TV settings and then go into the iTunes video settings, you'll notice there is now a toggle that says use cellular data for playback. And so if you allow the TV app to use cellular data for playback, you'll get a couple different additional options for setting the playback quality, whether you're on Wi-Fi or cellular. And you can set those quality levels separately. So you have two options for each, best available or good. And I assume, and as a matter of fact, I think it even says the good quality will actually use less data. Unfortunately, I couldn't find any specs from Apple, so I don't know how much less. I don't know what bandwidth level it's running at. But if you are limited to only being able to use a cellular data connection, you might want to go in and change those settings both to good, especially say on your iPhone or something like that, so that you are using less cellular data. So I hope that helps you out. You know, play around with the TV app a little bit, maybe quit out of it or try rebooting your device. If you're still getting it coming up with a completely blank screen, even when in airplane mode and when you have content downloaded locally, you're sure that you have actually loaded that either from iTunes or downloaded it while you were on a Wi-Fi connection and it's not showing up, you may consider doing a full backup of your device and try restoring it. And if that doesn't work, maybe contact Apple support and see what's going on, because even in airplane mode, it should be showing you in the library section of the TV app the content that's downloaded on your device. So give that a try, and hopefully that additional information helps you out. John wrote in recently after upgrading to Mac OS Sierra with a problem that I know is very annoying. It's a small issue, but it can be really frustrating. He said now when he drafts an email on his Mac, he sometimes gets dozens or even up to 30 or 40 copies of that same email in his drafts folder. And he said he contacted Apple support. He contacted us ISP. They've been going back and forth. And both of them are stumped. They can't figure out what's going on. And John, I'd have to say that would be really frustrating. I've never seen a scenario where I've gotten like 30 or 40 copies of the same draft email in my drafts folder. And I'm not sure if this is what's happening, but I have a theory based on a similar experience that I've had to this. And hopefully it's what's going on and can help you out. And I think it might not just be Mac OS Sierra that's caused the problem, but simply the way that Apple and the IMAP server that you're probably connecting to are regulating and managing your emails, specifically with the drafts folder. And my theory, the trouble, I believe, is that Apple does auto-saving as you're making your drafts, and your IMAP system, if you're syncing your drafts folder with the IMAP server, it's going to attempt to try and sync those drafts back to your Mac and to your other iOS devices. So my theory is that as you're composing your draft message, it's syncing to IMAP and then it's trying to sync back, and it's maybe seeing those as different messages and maybe those are showing up as kind of duplicates. So you're getting in this kind of syncing loop as you're creating draft emails. And the solution, in my opinion, is to make sure that for your accounts on both your Mac and your iOS devices, that you change the settings so that the drafts folder is just a local one and that it's actually not syncing to your IMAP server. And luckily, this is fairly easy to do. A lot of people don't realize that you can actually remap your IMAP folders in the Mail application on your devices and on your Mac. Now, unfortunately, you'll have to do this for each account, for each draft folder on each device or Mac, but once you've set it up one time, it should stay that way and it should help this issue go away. For me specifically, the issue that I've noticed is that I can often have draft messages that I've sent out. So I've finished drafting them, I've gone to send them out, and then I find that there's still a draft version of that email sitting in my drafts folder. So if you've noticed that too, this could be another fix for that as well. So on iOS, if you go into Settings, Mail, Accounts, and then you choose the account you want to change the setting for, and then when you're in there, tap on the email address to access that account's settings, and then you're going to want to tap on Advanced, and then tap on the Drafts Mailbox option under Mailbox Behaviors, and then you're going to want to tap the option for Drafts and set it to On My Device instead of the drafts folder on the server. And what that means is that when you go on that iOS device and you're composing a draft email, it's just going to save it locally on that device and it's not going to try and sync it up to the IMAP server. On the Mac, it's very similar. In Mail, you go into Mail Preferences, click on Accounts, then click on Mailbox Behaviors, and once again, make sure that the drafts mailbox is set to On My Mac and not on the server. And that, I think, should take care of this duplicate draft message situation. If it doesn't, email me back and we'll maybe dig into it a little bit further, or maybe someone in the MacCast community, if you've run into this specific issue where it's duplicating draft emails and it's not related to the drafts being on the IMAP server, let me know what the fix is and I'll try and cover it in the next episode of the MacCast. Now, of course, when you change this setting, the big disadvantage is that you will not be able to start a draft message in one place and then pick it back up in another. So you can't like start a draft on your iOS device and then get back to your Mac and then finish composing it there, because you're setting the drafts to only be stored on the local device. So if that's going to bother you, you probably have to turn the syncing back on and you may have to deal with these little duplicate issues. But to me, it's a small price to pay. That little bit of inconvenience is a small price to pay to get your drafts folder cleaned up and not have 30 to 40 copies of the same draft message in your box. That's crazy. And by the way, you may have noticed, or you may notice when you go into change these settings, that you actually have the ability to remap other folders. So you actually can change in mail.app where things like the junk, deleted, and archive messages are stored on your IMAP server. And this can come in handy because some ISPs call different folders different things. So this controls when you're in mail app and you're in the main mailboxes for trash, for drafts, for archive and stuff like that. When you click into those sections, this controls which folder it's going to sync with on your IMAP server. So sometimes you may have to remap those because maybe on your Mac, the folder is called spam, but on your ISP, they actually call it junk or vice versa, or whatever it might be. So you can remap those also from these mail settings. So check that out. And John, thanks for your email. And I hope that answer helps you out at least somewhat. So next up, I received a voicemail from Andrew, and he actually had a couple questions about Siri and Apple Maps. So let's see if we can help him out.
Hi, Adam. This is Andy. I've got a couple of questions regarding using Siri with Apple Maps hand-free. I sometimes get a verbal notice from Siri while I'm driving that there's a faster route available. And there is a green go button on the screen, but I shouldn't be touching the screen as I'm driving. So I'm trying to figure out what the right verbal command to Siri is to tell Siri to go ahead and go to that alternate route instead. I could swear that I once got it to work, but I don't remember the magic words and somehow can't make it happen again. Do you know how to verbally tell Siri to switch over to the alternate route that Siri suggested? The other question is whether or not Siri can be set up in such a mode where when there's bad enough traffic, if there would be a little bit faster route that's not on a freeway but are on surface streets. I've never had Siri give me that alternate route to go on surface streets. It seems like it just says, well, just stay on here. This is the best you can do. But it seems like I ought to be able to go on surface streets. And I think some of the other apps like Waze and Google Maps might give those alternate directions on surface streets. Do you know anything about that relative to Apple Maps and Siri? Thanks for your show. I'll talk to you later.
Hey, Andy, thanks for the question. I actually did some searching, and unfortunately, I was not able to find a definitive answer about how to verbally ask Siri to give you that alternate route. If I were to guess, purely guessing off the top of my head, I would try saying something like, go ahead and use alternate route, or just use alternate route. But it's something that's very hard to test because until she actually says, hey, there's an alternate route available, you really can't just like make that happen. So I really don't have any way to test it. So it's going to be a lot of trial and error. Hopefully, and then this is what I think you're hoping for, is hopefully someone in our MacCast community, maybe you know what the answer is for Andy, and maybe you can let us both know if you do. So send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. I can confirm for you, Andrew, though, or Andy, the other thing, that Siri will actually reroute you onto surface streets if that is the faster route. And the reason I know this is because it happened to George Starcher, Victor Cahiao, and I when we were going to the airport coming from MacStock this past year. There was actually some traffic, and it rerouted us, and we went some crazy back routes through the outskirts of Chicago on our way to the airport. So it absolutely does happen. It will happen if it is appropriate. I can also tell you about the one time where Siri rerouted me in a quicker route that was going to save me 3 minutes. And what she did was there was a bunch of traffic and she took me off one freeway off ramp and right back onto the on ramp on the other side, therefore bypassing the jammed up traffic. Probably not 100% legally, at least here in the state of California, to get me around the traffic. So even when she does reroute you onto surface streets, it may not always be the best route or the best idea for you to take. Had a police officer been on that off ramp, I think I might have been in a little bit of trouble. I guess I could have just said, "Oh, I accidentally got off on the wrong off ramp" or something like that. But I think it's generally frowned upon as a method for saving time or getting around traffic. But I will tell you, as much as I like this new user interface for how it gives turn-by-turn directions and things like that, I will say that I kind of agree with what I think you're saying, that in general, I find the new interface worse for safety while driving, because a lot of the information that you used to have access to is kind of hidden under panels, and it seems to require touching the screen more than it actually should. For example, like functions to get the route overview or the list of directions, the details, are actually hidden in what Apple calls the route card. And this is the thing you have to kind of swipe up from the bottom on, and then you get the route card, and then you can tap to get the overview. In the past, there was just an overview button right on the interface, so it was one tap versus a swipe and a tap. So again, requiring you to kind of interact with the screen more than you would want to. Also, the nearby and the audio controls are in that same route card panel, so getting to that stuff is not as convenient. Now, there are voice commands for those, luckily, where you can kind of ask for certain things nearby via Siri. But, you know, iTunes is also similar to this. The new iTunes interface, as beautiful as it is, it has this whole card concept. And I find, like, when I want to bring up the audio controls and things like that, they're really tiny, and I'm having to hunt and peck and search for them. So safety-wise, when you're in the car, it's not so great. And I think Apple needs to recognize that not everybody out there, as much as they would like, not everybody out there has Siri Eyes Free or CarPlay in their car. So, you know, they should have thought about this a little bit more. So I'm a little bit with you there. But I did, as I was doing my searching, find some other helpful tips and tricks and pages that can kind of give you a little more information about the kinds of commands that you can use with Siri, specifically when navigating maps. There's a great page on Apple's website, the Siri iOS page. If you go to apple.com/iOS/Siri, it has a bunch of helpful hints, all kind of organized into categories. And there is a category they call Out and About that has some good ones, and they're all designed for navigation and maps and things like that. And one of them is you can say, "I'm running low on gas," and it will use that nearby feature to actually help find you a nearby gas station. Unfortunately, again, when I tested this, it's only on screen, so you kind of have to have it come up on screen, and then you're still going to have to tap from one of the selections to have it get you there. If you say, "Take me to the nearest gas station," it tends to be a little bit of a better command because it'll jump you right into the directions for the nearest gas station. But once again, I think you still have to kind of say or tap go. There may be a delay where if you just wait, it will actually start to kick in and give you the directions. I'm not 100% positive on that one. But you might try "take me to the nearest whatever thing you're looking for" as a command to get more direct. For people that are in your contacts or for information it knows about addresses that you frequent, you can say things like "take me home" or "take me to David Sparks' house." If you happen to have David Sparks in your contact list, I do, so it will get me to his house and it'll give me directions automatically that way. Another kind of cool thing that you can say is, "how long will it take me to get to," and the name of a location, and it will give you the estimated route time based on current traffic conditions and things like that. So those are some helpful ones. There's more of those on that page. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com, so you can check that out. They also have all the other categories like sports and things, so you can kind of browse through and see all the different things that you can do, conversions and all the different Siri commands. So if you're looking for those specific phrases like you mentioned, that might be a helpful place to look. And there used to be a great website, we talked about it on an episode of the Mattcast in the past, called heysiri.io. And it had all of the commands for Siri. And it was kind of this running database. And they would update it. And people, I think it was crowdsourced. And people could put in suggestions and things. And I thought that would be the place that would tell me the answer to your question. Unfortunately, when I went there, the site was completely shut down. They had shut down the project. Luckily, though, they actually have downloads. They have a PDF They have a markdown file and even a JSON file if you're a web developer and want to build your own version of it. I guess you could use their data in their database through a JSON file and you could set it up. So you can still get the information there, just not as easily. It's not quite as searchable and laid out as well. You'll have to do that layout yourself, I guess, from the markdown or the JSON file. But you can grab the PDF and that will give you a helpful list of Siri commands that you may be able to use. So check that stuff out. And again, thank you for your question. Well, apparently, if you're going to take the bar exam in North Carolina or Colorado, the bar is actually barred from the bar. And if you're a little confused right now, apparently Apple's new Touch Bar on the MacBook Pro is being banned from the bar exam because it's not compatible with the security features of the ExamSoft software that's used in many of those testing facilities. So I guess it has maybe some way that it allows you to bypass the security features and potentially maybe cheat on the exam. And in some cases, they, to deal with that, are just completely barring MacBook Pros. And iMore had an interesting story about this in a piece mentioning that unfortunately, you cannot disable the Touch Bar on the MacBook Pro, which is kind of what's causing them to ban it from the testing facilities. But they do point out that there is actually a way to cripple the Touch Bar so that it will be locked down to only the control strip functions, the system features like brightness and sound. And I didn't know that this was actually possible. I didn't think there was this kind of tweaking you could do with it. But if you go into System Preferences and you go into the keyboard preferences and then click on the keyboard tab, it has a touch bar section. And under that, you can actually click the little drop down and select the expand control strip option. And that will lock it so that the touch bar only functions for the control strip, no matter what application that you are in. They also mention that you can make the function keys of the touch bar the default on the display so that you will only have it working as a function bar. The one thing about this is that unlike the locking it down to the control strip, when you do this, you actually have to do it on an app-by-app basis. So to switch in your app to make sure that the touch bar only brings up or only displays the function keys, what you can do is you go into System Preferences, go into Keyboard, and then go into the Shortcuts tab, and then select Function Keys from the sidebar. And then under the Function Keys section, click the Add button, the little plus, and then select the app that you want to display the function keys on the touch bar for as the default, and click Add. And then once you've done that, whenever you're using that app, the default display for the touch bar will only be the function keys. Obviously, to undo it, just go into the same section and remove that app from the function key section for the touch bar, and you should be back to normal. But a couple little tweaks on the touch bar that may be handy, all predicated by the fact that it's getting barred from the bar exam. Apparently, and I didn't know this, starting in Mac OS Sierra, the Mac is now reporting the free space that's on your hard drive a little bit differently than it did before. And Gary, our friend Gary here on in the MacCast community, may have found a way where you can actually force your way into gaining a little extra space on your Mac. So here's what Gary wrote in, or called in actually to tell us.
I also wanted to mention that a recent issue that I had with my iPhone, based on the amount of storage that I do have, is 256 gigabyte. Most of it is used up. It's about half full. So in order for me to do an encrypted backup on my Mac, I need quite a bit of storage available for it to back up. And going into my System Preferences and looking at the hard drive, mine showed like 125 gigabytes available of 499 gigabytes. And I was like, all right, well, that should be plenty. You know, it doesn't need anything. But doing the encrypted backup on iTunes, it kept saying there's not enough space available. And I'm like, well, how much do you need? And it really, looking at the numbers that iTunes would show, it just wasn't there. I did speak to Apple, and they kind of went troubleshooted with me on a number of things, and then I just thought of that trick that people use on iPhone where they maybe download a movie from iTunes on their iPhone for like 4 gigs, and it forces the phone to like purge stored music, free up space in photos, and all of a sudden you've got this extra space that you can do what you want with and don't get that error. So I thought, okay, let's try this on the Mac. So I duplicated a 10 gigabyte file about, you know, 12 times, and then I deleted it, and it actually turned all of the purgeable space in my Mac to available. And I thought, well, this is kind of, you know, like a glitch thing where iTunes should really know how to manage that purgeable space or the system. So wanted to give you that bit of feedback and to say how painful it is to restore from backup any phone now. And it's just very frustrating. And I hope that Apple at some point makes it better. You know, it sounds so easy for that Apple text to say, just restore from backup, do it on your computer. You know, it saves all your passwords. But then you find out again that it unpairs your watch. You got to do that again. It deletes all of your Apple Pay credit cards. You got to do that again. You have to sign back into a variety of services that, even though it said it's going to save all your passwords, some of them it just doesn't save, and you pretty much have to go back and do all that again. And you're in this little bit of a fine-tuning mode for a little while longer. Plus, many of the features that you had turned on, like Wi-Fi calling or unlock my computer with my watch, all of those things have to be re-registered, including the fingerprint ID. It's a little bit painful. Maybe I've got, I'm a complainer. All right. Thanks, Adam.
Hey, Gary. Well, I'll tell you this. If you're a complainer, then you're just joining the club, because I think a lot of us are with you. I get emails almost weekly from members of the MacCast community complaining about the process of backing up and restoring your device. It's never fun. And there is a lot of rigmarole you have to go through. You know, for as much as the iOS devices and things are a bit more stable and you need to do that with less, it does seem like sometimes that's always the blanket solution. And I can tell you, I've had to tell people when they email me for support saying, you know, your last resort might be to back up and fully restore your device. And I almost always get pushback from people for this exact reason, because that actually can be a little bit painful. So you're not alone in that. Don't feel bad about that. But I want to get to this idea of freeing up purgeable space, and want to talk about why that worked for you and let people know what this concept, this idea of purgeable space is, because it's somewhat new. And starting with macOS Sierra, Apple did something that I think shows exactly what you experienced, which is if you go into the Apple menu and you say about this Mac and you look at the little storage tab, you will see your hard drive, and what you will see in there is you'll see the free space in white. And then you will probably also see this amount of space, quote unquote, free space that it calls purgeable. It'll have little gray lines running through that area representing the amount of purgeable. And so you have free space and you have purgeable space, and you'll have two different values in the about window. But if you access the available space on your hard drive, say you do a get info on the main hard drive, what you will find is that it reports as free space both, and this is starting with macOS Sierra, it reports as the free space, the amount of actual free space and purgeable space as free space. But here's the thing. The stuff that's called purgeable is not actually free. There's actually stuff stored there. So it's a little bit confusing. In the past, when you would look at most panels and most information, the only thing it would report back to you was the actual free space, that stuff that was in white. Now with macOS Sierra, it considers it all quote-unquote free space, but the purgeable is different. And as you found out when you did, you know, when you did your testing. And so what is the difference? What is purgeable? This is data that is actually on the disk. It's being used up, but Apple considers it to be basically expendable. It's stuff that can be thrown away. It can be removed as needed to get more space. So if this operating system, as you rightly pointed out, if the operating system needs more space, it's supposed to actually dip into that purgeable area and start throwing away and getting rid of some of that stuff to give you the space for, say, doing a critical iOS backup that you want to do. And why can it throw that stuff away? What files does it consider to be expendable? I know what files, because most of us would say none of our files are, you know, if we've put them on our disk, they're not really expendable. Well, so what it's talking about is files that might be stored in iCloud, dictionary files that you haven't used recently, large fonts, especially like extra language fonts for languages you're not using, like the Asian languages, things that you rarely or never use. As you pointed out, maybe downloaded TV shows or movies that you've already watched that you've purchased on iTunes that can actually be re-downloaded, or photos and videos that are synced with your iCloud photo library if you're using the, say, optimized Mac storage option. That stuff that's downloaded and cached, those can be thrown away. So it's basically stuff that you could get back. It could be re-downloaded from iCloud or from iTunes or some other location. That's all the stuff that is quote-unquote purgeable. And it should happen automatically. You're absolutely right. But as you discovered, not every app sort of treats that equally. And it seems like maybe iTunes isn't fully aware of how to handle that purgeable space. So your little workaround, your little hack of using the Finder, which is aware and able to purge that space, worked, right? You just kept duplicating a file till you ate into that purgeable space, which forced the Finder and the OS to actually throw that stuff out. And then when you deleted the files from the Finder, lo and behold, it's back in the free space area. So it seems right now, because this is relatively new to macOS Sierra, that maybe this feature is a little bit buggy. So I think your tip is a really good one if you're looking out for a way to force that. Now, for my part, I thought, wow, there's somebody has to have a utility or has to have figured out a way to kind of force this purgeable thing to happen, to sort of say, hey, I want you to actually clear the purgeable space. I didn't find a utility just doing some Google searching. I didn't look, to be honest, I didn't look really deeply, but just real quickly, I tried to see if I could find a utility. I didn't. So I think your little tip for now, actually, of just duplicating a large file or something that like that would work. Hopefully, you know, like a utility like Clean My Mac 3 or maybe Cocktail or one of those will actually add this functionality to kind of force the removable, you know, force to clear out that purgeable space. I don't know if Apple even allows that. It may be limited by the rules of the operating system that only Apple, you know, applications or the Finder or the OS itself is able to actually dip into and force that space to purge. But hopefully, you know, they'll kind of get this resolved where at least iTunes, if you want to do an encrypted iOS backup, will actually purge that. So thanks for writing in and letting us know about that. But with that, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of Smile's great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you're always welcome to send me emails or audio comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281 MacIM9 and leave a voicemail message there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, you can find me at twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.